So we've had such a rich taste of Hogan's teaching that it perhaps is a little odd that I'm going to introduce him now, but I'm going to do it anyhow. So it really is a great pleasure, and I'm really pleased to be able to welcome Hogan here to sit with us. I've known him for maybe around 15 years. Hogan began practicing in 1968 with Philip Kapler Roshi and was part of the residential staff at the Zen Center of Rochester until 1975. And he's lived and trained at the Zen Center of Los Angeles under Taizen Mizumi Roshi. And he has continued his practice studying with Rinzai Master Shoto Harada Roshi, and inspiringly, continually seeking out teachers who he feels have something that he can learn. And his practice has also brought him into the Vajrayana tradition, studying with Dan Brown. Hogan has been a leader of the Zen community of Oregon since 1985. And is the co-abbot of Great Vow Zen Monastery.
Thank you. So I gave you just a little taste of what is it, of maybe the fourth or fifth step of the tin oxidity pictures. And I think it's very important that as Dharma practitioners, as people of Zen, that we really understand this place of refuge in our own practice, in our own life. That it's very important that we know very intimately what we can count on, what's reliable. Because before thought, before the mind has gotten its all of its calculations and all of its problems and everything else, there is a place that's always, 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 always spacious and bright and easy. And when we are operating from that place, we're open to the nature of the world. And so I think that if there's a quality of that's very important for people of Dharma to have, it's this equanimity and confidence that comes from knowing that fundamental nature of our own nature, and being really open to the world as it is, the traffic and the strange sounds and all the problems that we have, and then coming from a place of warmth. So it is very, I feel it's very important that not only do we practice the great, still, bright mind, but that we also begin to cultivate, to begin to offer, to begin to generate, to express the warmth of our own hearts. How we view the world is how the world is. And so if we're viewing the world from a place of brightness and warmth, of loving kindness, of metta, as they say in Theravada Buddhism, the world becomes like that. It becomes an offering to the whole world. And so it's very important that as Zen practitioners, one of the nice things about our particular tradition is it brings this great stability and breadth of mind. It brings this great centeredness. It really is unmoved by all the vicissitudes of life. But then it has to also be warmed up. And so it's this knowing our foundation, and giving life to our life, giving life. I do a lot of different kind of retreats. We just finished our 140th week of Sesshin at Great Vow. We've been there for about 11 years, and we do a week of retreat every month. and when people are doing retreats, or when they're coming here to a Zazen group this evening, the people back home don't care what you did. They don't care what state of mind you encountered. They don't care how hard you worked. They don't care what you touched. They only care, do you come back a warmer, more loving person? If you come back warmer and more loving, if you come back with an open heart, everybody says, oh, go do it some more. Go do it some more. Keep practicing. If you come back cold and, you know, tight and, you know, kind of severe, nobody's interested in that. Nobody. So as Zen people who are able to really sit with the difficulties of life, to really sit very deeply and with great stability, really be open to the nature of the world, it is also incumbent upon us that we warm it up, that we bring forth metta. Loving-kindness practice is a practice of evenness. It means that we're looking across the board with an even loving eye at everything that happens. And when we're looking at an even loving eye at everything that happens, then we're open to life. We're open to all the things that are out there. And when we're open to life and we're open to what comes towards us, we can respond. We can respond skillfully. We can respond in a way that helps other people become open to life. Other people give life to their life. And then the Buddha Dharma in our life, in our Sangha, all move very seamlessly. It is really an honor to be at a place of practice, a place that obviously people have been sitting in, a place that the Buddha Dharma, the mind of Buddha Dharma has been cultivated. It is an extraordinary thing to encounter the Dharma in this way. I often think that the possibility of any one of us actually meeting, me actually touching Josh, of actually being right here, touching, the probability of that is infinitesimally small. All the places in the world that he could be, all the places in the world I could be, all the times in the world that we could be, and the fact that we are happen to be right here, right now, the fact that all of us are right here, right now, the probability is so absolutely small that we can only say it's a miracle. And the probability of actually encountering a teacher of Dharma, somebody like Josh or James or the other people bound this way, who have dedicated their lives, who have practiced Dharma, who have gone through the years and years and years it takes to cultivate, and have had the good fortune of coming together and bringing a place like this alive for other people's benefit, the probability of that is so infinitely small, we have to regard it as a miracle. We have to regard it as grace. We have to regard it as boundless compassion, the boundless way, that we are all the recipients of. So it's very wonderful for me to come to a place like this where I have people who have been dedicated themselves, who have been offering to try to inspire others, who other people have been inspired, who are offering to inspire others, and the Dharma unfolds through dedication and inspiration. In our particular lineage, we start off with Bodhidharma. Our typical image of Bodhidharma, of course, is one man who showed up from India, who came thousands of miles across the ocean, and that one man who was rejected, the Emperor of China said, I don't understand you, get out of here. He went and sat in the cave. And that one person affected his disciple, who affected his disciple, who affected more disciples, who affected more disciples, who affected more disciples. One single person with whom who awakens the Dharma in their own heart, and then with warmth, with integrity, with liveliness, shares that Dharma, shares their life meaningfully with each person they encounter, each time they touch somebody, each time they have a miraculous interaction. This is how the Dharma unfolds. This is why the Dharma has continued for 2,500 years, or I'm now practicing some in the Boon tradition. The Boon tradition says it's continued for 1,400 years. But if you look at the previous Buddhas, there's Buddhas upon Buddhas upon Buddhas, and it's always the way the truth has gone forward. Truth has always gone forward. One person, each of us, touching our own intimate nature and then giving life to our life and supporting other people and giving life to their life. And it goes on and on and on. And the Dharma is boundless. The Dharma is endless. The Dharma has gone through civilizations rising and falling because each person in their own being has the root of wisdom and kindness and compassion, and gives life to that in the world. So anyhow, we're all very fortunate. It's very, very nice to be here. Very nice to be here with you. Any religious professional can just talk on and on and on and on and on about whatever subject comes up, but I thought it might be interesting to see if you had any particular themes you'd like me to talk about, any particular comments or questions. I'm sure, knowing Josh's history, he was saying that he's been involved with 132 books from Wisdom Press that he has brought into life, into this world. So I'm sure he's probably talked about every possible Dharma theme I could even imagine, and probably some more. But anything else I can say a few words toward, I'll be happy to try to do that.
So I want to encourage all of you to step forward in a practice of generosity. What is it that's alive for you? What is it that's challenging for you? What is it that you'd like to look more deeply at?
So earlier when we were sitting, while you were guiding us through some of the steps, I felt this urge, which came up a couple of times, where I just wanted to get up from my seat and just run out of Zendo and just run home. And this is something that's come up for me over and over again, where I seem to be encountering something that's real, and it's really scary, and I just want to run away. And I didn't. I sat here. But can you say anything about that?
Sure. Well, first off, it's something that's very genuine for you. So it shouldn't be ignored. Now, how you respond to that, that's the important thing. So something comes up, some feeling comes up, some life experience comes up, some juice comes up. And do you embrace it? You say, oh, interesting stuff here. Let me just kind of take a deep breath and really, really feel it. Really, you know, let it give life to my life. Or do we feel it and we go, I'm out of here. If we go, I'm out of here, and we do that over and over, every time something really begins to hit us, you know, before we know, we're just running everywhere. So part of this tradition is, when something comes up like that, that means, yeah, there's some juice there. Great. How do we make our mind large enough to really feel our own life? Now, we contain everything. There's nothing we don't contain. You know, we contain the dark and the light. We contain absolutely brilliant, luminous nature. We also have our own karma, our own stuff that we've run from for a lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. So, first of all, I'd say, yeah, great. Something good is, you know, coming up here, something very genuine. And then you have to enlarge the awareness. If you get into a battle with it, I hate this, I don't like this, I don't like this, I don't like this, you know, you get exhausted. You get exhausted, and eventually you say, what's the point, and give up. It's when we enlarge the mind, that is, we enlarge our awareness. You know, you've got this fear that comes up, this dislike that comes up. If I'm looking at my hand, one way of examining this, I'm looking at my hand, I'm actually in my aware place looking at my hand. So if we can move back into the awareness of, yeah, here's some juicy feelings, I will hold it. Then you'll be interested to see it will evolve. Whatever is coming up will come up, and something else will come up. Something else will evolve from it. The nice thing about Zazen is when we're sitting here in this kind of way with nothing else to do, that's why these things come up. There's nothing else to do. All of our usual distractions and all the computers and emails and video games or whatever it is we do to keep things at bay, they're not there. And suddenly all that stuff begins to come up that we've kept at bay. And so instead of running back to our habitual pattern, to really stay right with it, kind of interesting. Kind of interesting. Something's juicy there. So it's not. There's nothing wrong. Nothing wrong. And actually, it's a sign that there's you know, that something will unfold. If you say, yeah, I'm gonna embrace my own life. So, congratulations.
Say a little more on how one might kind of actively fire up the compassion. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know it happens part naturally just through doing zazen, but
sometimes.
Are there ways of, I mean, I know in, say, Vipassana, you know, it's a practice of metta.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something that can help you cultivate that within this tradition.
Have you practiced metta? Have you practiced loving kindness?
I've tried. Found it very hard.
Okay. So the first thing that you have to do, this is from the Theravadin school, you have to find that little girl in you that you dislike, that's whining, that's critical, that's imperfect, that's small and shriveled and ugly, that you just wish she would disappear, that you wish that she just was not part of your life, and you have to turn your loving, compassionate eye to her. Until you can love that part of you that is absolutely disreputable and absolutely reprehensible, you can't really do the other kind of loving practice. So you start off by bringing her to your consciousness. All the shame, all the embarrassment, all that, everything, the critical voices in there criticizing, that critical voice that says, you're no good at this, you're no good at that, you're no good at this, you can't do this, you bring up that part that the critic criticizes, and instead of falling back into criticism, you offer loving kindness. May you be free from fear and anxiety. May you be at peace. May you be happy. And we have to really, really genuinely want that child in us. Please, by offering my heart, please, may you be free from fear and anxiety. May you be at peace. The bottom of my heart, I wish you to be happy. And then we do that with that part of ourselves. And we can do it with other things that are easy to love. If you have an animal you love, or a child, or somebody that you genuinely love, to offer that. But it has to start here. It doesn't start right here with that room. It's all fake. And that's the way you give some juice to that.
Thank you.
Yeah. We have this idea that, I'll be loving out there, and I'll make everybody else, loving, I'll generate loving kindness in the fact by the fact I'm saying the phrases or turning my mind in that way. Yeah, that's nice. It's better than the opposite. But I'm going to hate everybody. But the real key is this part of yourself. And that's the way Theravadin practice begins. It always says begin with yourself. You don't quite say what that means, though. It means begin with the most horrible part of yourself. And offer that love. Everything else will come. That's one thread that you can use. Okay.
So, something that I've always sort of been preoccupied with is how many different sorts of religious traditions and practices more obviously talk about the idea of healing. And I've always sort of been interested in how I feel like Zen doesn't obviously talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think a lot of people do come to something like meditation or Zen or any yoga, you choose it, seeking healing maybe in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could maybe elucidate, what Zen might say about healing, any kind of, I guess, healing in general.
Sure. Well, we have to look at the mind and look at our life in different levels, of course. So on one hand, if we've got a toothache, we've got to get it dealt with. We've got to take care of it. So the first level is just to really know this body and mind. So what does it need? Does it need love? Does it need a dentist? Whatever it needs. I mean, that's the first level of healing. We really have to pay attention to that. And then, of course, there are some things that, I don't care how long you meditate and how deeply you meditate, if your tooth has to come out, it's not going to pop out by itself. So sometimes we have to really, I've got to get some help with this particular thing. It's one level. Perfectly important, vital level. Another level down is we cause ourselves so much suffering. I mean, it's like, some people are just taking their heads and beating them against the pillar all the time. Flagellating themselves. So another level of healing is to really learn how to not do that. And as soon as you stop beating yourself, you'll be amazed how much better you'll feel. So that's another level of healing, is to work with the mind, to really understand the nature of the mind, to really understand the spaciousness, or work with the inner critic, or whatever needs to happen in that way. A third level down is we have to be one with our body. If we're not one with our body, and we're just, you know, thinking heads, or we're, you know, kind of caught, or, you know, we're all in knots here, and the energy is not flowing through the body, then of course, the body does not, you know, begins to atrophy in different parts, it begins to get stuck. So part of Zazen is this whole body breathing, this whole body being aware and being sensitive to the whole body all at one time. And it's amazing that when we do that, a lot of energy is freed up. There's a flow of energy that happens at a very deep level. It's another level of healing. The third level of our fourth or fifth level of healing is our relationship to the world. You know, we sometimes think of healing as I got a headache, I'll take some aspirin, that's one kind of healing. But our relationship to the world, the way that we interact with everyone, the way that we interfuse with everyone, the way that we meet people on Monday morning, the way that we handle ourselves on the weekends, the way we interact with our children and spouses, to heal that by understanding real refuge, by understanding the deep nature of mind, by fostering loving kindness, by compassion, by knowing patience and spaciousness, to heal that level of thing is another level of healing in this tradition. At another level yet, the nature of the world is samsara. Everything that's born gets old and dies. Everything that rises falls. That's just the way things are. So another level of healing is to really say, okay, this is the nature of things. I will work in accordance with the nature of things. I will follow my life and respond appropriately to the nature of things. And so I will not try to be a 20-year-old when I'm 50. You know, one of my teachers used to say 20-year-olds have to practice like 20-year-olds, and 50-year-olds and 60-year-olds have to practice like 50 and 60-year-olds. Well, that's true with living our life. You know, there are certain life demands that if we really are living appropriate to our age and circumstance, there's a kind of healing that happens there. The deepest level of healing is to see that which is unborn. To see that no matter what happens, there is a place that is bright and clear, that is birthless, that is deathless, that has no beginning. It's absolutely, completely, 100% reliable. And it is your very own essential nature. To actually have that level of practice, to touch that even a little bit, suddenly all sorts of things fall away that were problems before. And you might get cancer and die. But that's not so important, because you understand the deeper level of what is really true, what is really wholesome. So I think that as practitioners, as spiritual practitioners, we have to hit this at all these different levels. If someone has a history of post-traumatic stress, it needs to be dealt with in a certain kind of way. If you have a toothache, it needs to be dealt with in a certain kind of way. If you need probiotics, it needs to be dealt with in a certain kind of way. If you really want to know, understand where you came from before you were born, that needs a certain kind of medicine too. So, big answer just says basically, you know, use everything as medicine. There's a great, I don't know if it's a koan. It's a koan maybe in the Blue Cliff Record. Where the Buddha's physician, Jiveka, I think his name was, my mind is doing two things at once here. The final exam was, is there anything in the world that cannot be used as medicine? And Jiveka, you know, passed it by saying, everything can be used as medicine. Everything is medicine. In the Blue Cliff Record, there's a koan, medicine and sickness heal each other. The very fact that something is amiss brings forth some response to it. The very fact that we are unhappy and that we are suffering brings forth a response to it. And when we can see the response and what is called forth and become one with that and see the wholeness of that, that too is healing. There is a part of the Vimalakirti Sutra says that the nature of practice, the cause of all Buddhas is dukkha, is suffering. It is our very suffering itself that is the cause of our impulse to wholeness. So in a way we can actually say that all of the things that beset us, all of the, you know, the vicissitudes, all the challenges that we have are in themselves the medicine for what deeply ails us, for the deep place in our mind that we have lost our essential connection. So, and you can become a doctor.
We have a little. We can take a few more questions.
I can just start talking again if you want. But
I think
I'd rather.
Mike has a question over there.
Yes.
I'm not sure I'm going to be able to say it well, but let's see. So this question, these questions are bringing up things for me too. This question around healing and. I'm curious about those times when somebody feels wounded or in pain or incomplete in some way. They don't feel whole. Are not able to touch into what might feel like a more boundless kind of holding. What would you say then?
I mean, people like all of us.
Yeah.
It is. The path of practice is extremely important, and it's not easy. And so we start off with these, 10 ox herding pictures. We start off with the very beginning of the path, and something doesn't feel right. Dissatisfaction, dis-ease, dismay. The challenges of our life have beset us. And we don't have any refuge. We don't know what to do. And so it is exactly that feeling is what is the fuel for the path, the fuel for what I was mentioning earlier. So what do? We do the best we can do. If we have the good fortune of having a teacher, having a sangha, we practice the best we can practice. Inadequately, unskillfully, incompletely, but we practice. And so by just continually practicing, we gradually become more skillful. This is not just, if you look at the 10 oxidative pictures, it's not just you sit down, you have one intense session, you have one magnificent, bright opening, and suddenly, bam, all your problems are solved and liberated all sentient beings with one big crack. There's some stories in the great literature that talk about those experiences. That isn't the way it usually works for most people. It's usually a long, slow unfolding of faith, of practice. So I think that I was asking Josh what he was going to be writing about, what he was really moved to work about, and he said faith. And so I think you have a wonderful guide here, because if we have exemplars, we have a path, and we have faith in that path, if we walk that path, it will open up. It will reveal itself. We cannot help but see it if we keep going. But one of the sutras says the path is littered with dead bodies. These people just, they practice a little while and they hit something and they run away from it and their mind just starts going crazy and they didn't build up some story or case and they stop practicing. If you have the good fortune, which you do, of having found the path, the good fortune that you've already taken refuge, the good fortune of having a teacher, the good fortune of actually taking on responsibilities for a community, because that keeps us practicing sometimes when we can't practice any other way, is our bodhisattva vow to help others, then the Dharma will inevitably unfold in you. And it will inevitably unfold in you because it was never missing. But it's just a matter of our eye looking carefully and carefully and carefully and carefully and seeing what has always been. And then we give life to it. So, yeah. Gambatte at this age. Keep going. Yeah.
wonder if you might comment on the relationship between faith in our practice and verification. It's one of the things or teachings that originally sort of resonated with me is this notion that we should continually sort of verify what's working for us and test what's working for us, which is in many ways the opposite of faith. And as we move on with our practice, I'm wondering if you could comment on how you sort of navigate.
Sure, I think it's actually very, very important to be able to do that. Some traditions would call metacognitive awareness, that you have to have the ability to periodically step back and say, what's going on here? Is my mind getting more clear? Am I able to concentrate? Am I sitting here? Sometimes I've seen people who would sit in a Zendo and they would practice being unskillful for years because they never really stood back and said, is this working? They never really stepped back and said, is my heart, am I opening my heart up? Am I becoming more flexible? Am I becoming more tolerant? Instead, they were practicing thinking, I'll just sit here more and more firmly and more and more rigidly, and you know, they just say, I'm going to be more determined. And before you know it, they're just this, you know, wall of stick. Because they did not really step back and say, how's it going? Now, so I think that a metacognitive evaluation of, am I being more concentrated? Am I practicing loving kindness? Is my heart being more open? Am I being more skillful in my daily life? Am I able to engage more skillfully with people? Am I taking a step back from the chattering, wandering mind? Am I less and less critical? I think that's a very, very important thing. On the other hand, if we do that all the time, if we're every single period we're sitting there trying to evaluate, is this breath okay? Is that breath okay? How about this breath? How about this part of the breath? Drive you crazy. So the Dalai Lama, he says, there are different teachings about this. The Dalai Lama says every couple of years, you know, you're practicing seriously, every couple of years you step back and you take stock. Like, who was that person I was a couple of years ago? How's the evolution? Another thing is if you have a specific criteria, the criterion is to have a more concentrated mind. Well, you can sit and you practice for an hour or so and you can really look and say, okay, if what I am doing to concentrate my mind, is that working or not? Am I being more skillful with a concentrated mind? If I'm not being skillful, what do I need to do to become more skillful to concentrate the mind? Concentrating the mind is one step of practice. It's not it's an essential step, but not certainly not a fulfillment of the path. So there are specific things that we can do. Is my girlfriend or my partner think that I'm a kinder person? Periodically, you should step back and see. I mean, there's nothing better for me if I'm dealing with our Sangha. The way I know somebody's really making progress is by asking their partner. You know? They can say all sorts of things, but if their partner says, this person really has changed, then I say, great. And to me, that's perfect metacognitive awareness right there. So I think that there's appropriate places to do that, but if the mind is always judging, good, bad, right, wrong, success, failure, am I doing it? I'm not. Exhausting. You'll fail, of course, and you'll give up practice. So I think it's a useful thing to do, but in a judicious way. Yeah. And if you're in a Sangha that is an affirming Sangha that manifests loving kindness, that really evokes loving kindness, then of course the whole Sangha will kind of pull you along in that engaged, loving way. It's a nice, nice kind of feedback also. Going once, going twice. Thank you all very much.
Thank you so much, Hogan, for your generosity and your teaching.
Talking. I began practicing in 1968. In Philip Capello, I was in a residential practice center where we did session every month and practiced. And then I went to practice with Maizumi Roshi, and I practiced with this guy, Shota Harada Roshi, for many, many, many years. Now I'm practicing. We've had Theravadan teachers, Ajahn Amaro, Ajahn Sumedho, and people from that Thai forest tradition. We've had many people from Vajrayana tradition. Had many, many different kind of practitioners. Every single teaching of the Buddha Dharma has something, there's some wisdom there. I feel it's very important for the depth, stay with one tradition. You found a particular tradition, you stay deeply with that tradition, but then you widen your understanding by embracing other aspects of Dharma. So to become deeply, deeply, deeply grounded, and you know, every tradition has its own magnificent wisdom, and then become very wide. So I think if we have that combination of real depth and the absolute confidence that comes out of real depth of one's tradition, and the flexibility and appreciation that comes out of just being a really wide human being, it's tasted all sorts of things and seen all sorts of truths. That to me is a wonderful combination. And so I think you have a very good model here with Josh, who's been involved with the Zen Buddhist tradition but has managed to, you know, get appreciated by teachers from all sorts of traditions for his breadth of mind. So I think you have a very nice, your leader is a very nice combination of that depth and that breadth. And so I really want to encourage everyone to have deep faith and confidence in where you're sitting. Have deep faith and confidence in the teachers that you encountered, and to really, really use them and to support and work with them so that other people can also benefit. So we're all so blessed. It's really the four divine abidings, they call the four immeasurables. You can't measure loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. You can't measure them. Loving kindness is unmeasurable. And so to have the good fortune of being in an environment that is filled with loving kindness and wisdom and all the immeasurables, please, please, please taste it really, really deeply. Digest it really, really fully. And then offer it to others in the most genuine, authentic way you possibly can. And that way everybody becomes a teacher of Dharma. Everybody. And that's how the Dharma goes forward. That's how the Dharma is given life. So thank you all very much for listening for a few minutes.